of Paul's second letter to Timothy, the last letter that Paul wrote, a passage that is very, very personal in many ways, and yet a passage that is very full of instruction, a passage that is very full of the kind of truth that can challenge us very, very deeply. We will not cover the whole of the passage tonight. We will come back to it finally next Sunday evening. When a man has served Christ for a lifetime, as Paul had served Christ, when a man has suffered, as Paul had suffered, for Christ and the gospel, when a man has given himself not only to Christ, but to Christ's people, which is the church, to serve them with a total self-denying commitment, as Paul had done, and when the hand of God in blessing has rested so significantly on a man and on his ministry, as had been the case with Paul, then it is always good to listen to that kind of man. Especially when that man knows, as Paul knew, that his end is very near. And Paul is very aware of the fact that he hasn't long to go. He knows that his end is near, and he knows that very soon he will stand before God to give an account to God about the people who were in his charge, about the work that had been committed to him, and to give an account of himself and his own dealings with Christ and with the gospel. It is good to listen to such a man, and you can listen to such a man safely, even though you may feel that you must make some allowance for his age and for his circumstances. But you can still listen to the man safely, especially because we believe that what is written in Scripture is God-given. These are not the casual meanderings of a man who knows that he hasn't long to go before his funeral. These are the words of a man who still writes by the direct inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And therefore this personal passage towards the end of his last letter is there for our benefit and for our blessing. And the first thing we have to do is to notice that twice in the passage, first of all in verse 9 and then again in verse 21, Paul asks Timothy to come as quickly as possible. Do your best to come to me soon. Do your best to come before the winter sets in, because that at a certain stage the climatic conditions were such that travel after that would be quite impossible. And Paul is really saying, now Timothy, do your best to come before winter, because I'm not going to last till the spring. Now why does he ask this of Timothy? Was this a desire for fellowship? Well, in his circumstances, in prison, waiting execution, you could understand his desire for fellowship. Was it that he was aware of a need for support? He did not ever think himself infallible or totally self-sufficient. Yes, he knew the grace of God was sufficient for him, but being human and increasingly human, I believe there were times that Paul desperately needed someone to stand with him. And these may be the reasons behind his appeal. Do your best, Timothy, to come to me as soon as you possibly can. Now, when Paul wrote these words, he was fully aware of the fact that if Timothy were to answer this request, as Timothy would certainly try to do, It would mean that Timothy, the young missionary minister, would have to leave his own work, his own congregation, possibly in the city of Ephesus. And I don't think Paul would have asked Timothy to do this just for Paul's own personal comfort and encouragement and reassurance. I tend to feel that Paul was aware of a tremendous need, not for personal support, but for support for the testimony of the gospel. Not just at the time of his trial, when he was due to appear yet again in Caesar's court on trial for his life, but need for support for the testimony of the gospel and to shepherd the flock after Paul's execution. Now, I'm not exaggerating here because, you see, as far as I can gather, Paul died at the hands of the Roman Emperor Nero. Now, if you know anything at all about history, you will know that that must have been a grim time in the city of Rome. It was a time within Nero's own family of terrible, murderous atrocities. History books testify to this. It was a time when Christians were being blamed for the great fire in Rome. You know that Nero fiddled while Rome burned. But there's a great political upheaval, you see. This shouldn't have happened. Oh, Nero had his escape already. Oh, is it? It was the Christians. It was the Christians. And it would be public knowledge that this great leader of the Christian missionary movement, the man called Paul, was in Caesar's jail at that particular time. Can you imagine something of the intensity and the fury for vengeance upon the Christians? And Christians were being made the scapegoat. I suppose the time of Nero is so far away that we can read about terrible things without taking too much notice. Some of us can think back to the time of that diabolical character called Hitler, when in the whole of Europe it wasn't safe to be a Jew because the gas ovens were ready. It was like that for the Christians in Rome at the time of Nero. Except that they didn't use gas ovens, they had the lions in the arena. They made sport out of it. Some of us here tonight can think back to the time of Joseph Stalin, that cruel, diabolical character, so cold and so calculating. But as I look out upon you tonight, many of you can't even think properly back to that. All right, then think of the Ayatollah in Iran. Think of the deep and desperate hatred that there is among those who would set in motion what they would call a holy war. Absolutely without compassion. You wouldn't like to be a Christian in Iran just now, would you? Especially if the hijackers do as they say they're going to do in the news tonight and blow up that aeroplane. You wouldn't like to be a Christian in Iran, would you? Paul wasn't just too much at peace in his mind about being a Christian in Rome at the time of Nero. And I begin to understand more fully than ever before just how much feeling there was when he says twice over to Timothy, "Do your best to come to me soon." Whatever the reasons behind the request, Paul wanted Timothy there, I believe, because Timothy, though he was possibly only about half Paul's age, Paul in his early 60s, Paul, Timothy perhaps in his early or middle 30s, Paul wanted Timothy because Timothy was the kind of man and the kind of fellow worker to whom with freedom of heart and confidence of heart, Paul could say things about himself and about other people and know that Timothy could be trusted. Put it like this, I believe at this particular juncture, Paul needed somebody of real spiritual caliber and real human compassion. And these two should always go together. There's something wrong if they don't. Paul needed a man like that beside him to tide him through what I believe was the major and the most demanding crisis of his whole life. But I want you to notice how the 10th verse comes very, very closely after verse 9, giving reason for the depth of feeling in Paul's request. Timothy, do your best to come to me soon, because Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. We won't weary ourselves tonight with looking up too much references, but elsewhere in the New Testament is made plain that at one time Demas had been a close companion and a fellow worker with Paul. But now, oh, listen carefully, my friends, the man who had been a close companion and a fellow worker was now a grief and a burden. I found myself wondering, when Demas departed from Paul, when he decided to go, had he any idea that for the whole of the history of the Christian church, his defection would be public? Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me. Let me say now, I don't know whether Demas was truly converted or not. I'm not sure if he is a real Christian or not. But if he was a real Christian, there will be many, many, many people in heaven who will say to Demas, and he'll feel it, Demas, whatever possessed you to desert Paul at that particular time? Do your best to come to me soon, for Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Demas deserted me, says Paul. Whether he speaks personally or whether he speaks of the work of the gospel, I don't quite know. I'm left asking questions that I can't really answer. Why did Demas decide to go? Were the demands too great? Did Paul expect too much from him? Had he become aware of the fact that Paul was expecting Demas to give the same kind of willing self-sacrifice and commitment as Paul himself was giving? I find myself recalling meeting with the elders as they then were, way back in 1956 in the vestry through there, meeting with them before my induction. And we talked about a number of things, and I remember saying to them, I will not ask of you anything that I'm not prepared first to do myself. But after all these many years, I would change the wording a little. And I would say, whatever I expect myself to do, I would expect from you the same kind of commitment, the same kind of self-sacrificing commitment, reorganizing the whole of your life as I have to reorganize mine in order that you might be available for Christ and for the gospel. And I believe that it was at a point like that, maybe on one occasion when Paul was preaching, that Demas said to himself, "No, I'm not prepared for that kind of commitment." And so Demas, in love with this present world, says Paul, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Why Thessalonica? I don't know. His thinking could have been, well, you know, there's a good going church in Thessalonica. And so there was. And Demas might have thought it was the kind of church in which he might be able to hide from the real claims of Christ in terms of discipleship. I don't know. Did he go to Thessalonica for business reasons? I don't know. Maybe he was a businessman. Maybe he felt that if he contracted a bit out of this, all this gospel business, he would be able to get on far better in his business life. And then, of course, he'd be able to give quite a bit of money to the work of the gospel. Did he go to Thessalonica for personal reasons? Was there someone in Thessalonica that he wanted to be with? I don't know. We can't tell. But one thing is absolutely clear about Demas, and Paul says it. Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me. Well, what does that mean? To be in love with this present world. Had it to do with comfort? We all like our comfort. Don't know how we get on in concentration camps, especially in the winter. We feel martyred if our electric blankets don't work. Was it in terms of career that he was in love with the present world? Was it in terms of popularity? Oh, that awful curse. How many ministers are tongue-tied, and how many Christians are tongue-tied in terms of witness because of this awful thing of popularity? Oh, it can mean so much to us that people should like us. Don't we want God to like us? Don't we want Jesus to be pleased with us? Was it in terms of pleasure that Demas was in love with this present world? Oh, I recognize, my friend, that real Christian commitment is costly. It's hard work. It really is. And oh, how many Christians there are who contract out of the real hard work of Christian commitment. Oh, they don't abandon the faith. Oh, no, they still go to churches and meetings and this and that. But their essential motivation is this, that they go to things that they enjoy. That's really idolatry. The idolatry of pleasure. Was it materialism? Was it acceptability with worldly people or acceptability with Christian people? I don't know. Paul simply says, Demas, in love with this present world, deserted me. Notice the contrast we've got between the end of verse 9 and verse 10. The end of verse 8, rather, and verse 10. Paul is speaking of the crown of righteousness to all who have loved his appearing. But Demas didn't love his appearing. Demas was in love with this present world. And this raises the question that I mentioned in passing earlier on, a question that I cannot really answer, and it's not my business to answer it. Was Demas a Christian? Was he a truly converted man? Was he in the real biblical sense a believer, or was he not? I don't know. But what I do know is that I can draw your attention to three different references in Scripture. The first is just a few pages over in the first epistle of John, chapter 2 at verse 15. A most uncomfortable verse. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in him. That's pretty blunt, isn't it? Well, in the light of that verse, was Demas a Christian or was he not? Turn back to John's Gospel. John's Gospel, chapter 15, at verse 19. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. But there was no suggestion that the world hated Demas. He went away to Thessalonica because he knew that he would be accepted there. He could settle down there. He would be happy there. Things would be simple there. Turn back a little further to the Gospel according to St. Matthew, chapter 7, at verse 21. Know how I remember my brother preaching a sermon on this text in Gilcomston South Church in Aberdeen way back in the late 1940s. I don't remember many sermons that long, but I remember going hot and cold throughout this sermon. The text was, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Doing the will of the Father and deserting Paul, as Paul describes it at that particular juncture in the word, do these two go together? Read through our verses in Matthew. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Demas did. And cast out demons in your name? Possibly Demas did. And do many mighty works in your name? Certainly Demas was associated with Paul in the work of the gospel. Then, says Jesus, will I declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you evil doers. Back to Timothy. Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. I can't say whether he was truly converted or not. And I acknowledge that the whole question of backsliding is a solemn one. And I want you to think about it, and I use these kind of words. People sometimes say to me, do you ever hear of, and they mention a name, and I say, oh, haven't heard of them for years. Oh, people say, you know, they used to be so regularly in Sandyford. Yes. Where are they now? I don't know. Do they go to church? I don't know. I know the minister in the town where they stay, but he says they don't go to his church. The minister was talking to me on the phone on Saturday. And he spoke to me about a man who used to be so regular here, who eventually went to another place and went to this man's church. Well, he's left that man's church now. He's been in it for years, a Christian man. You can see him after the service is going away down the road smoking his pipe. But in all the years that he's been in that church, he never once has been at the prayer meeting. Oh, you say, is that man not converted? Oh, it's not for me to say. I'm just describing the story of one who could well be called Demas. Do you ever hear of so-and-so nowadays? Are they still engaged in Christian service? I don't know. At one time, yes. But now, no more. And my friends, according to the gospel, the proof of spiritual life is continuance and perseverance. And Demas' story is recorded here in one simple verse. Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me at this critical time and gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia. Now, we don't know anything about this man, Crescens. It's going to be quite interesting in heaven, you know. We're going to meet all sorts of people. Oh, I've heard your name. I'm so pleased to meet you, to discover what kind of person you are. Well, obviously, we don't know who Crescens was, but his own generation did. That's why Paul is able to mention him. And there could very well have been a whole lot of people who owed their conversion to Crescens. Well, says Paul, Crescens has gone to Galatia. But some translations indicate that Crescens went to Gallia, which would be Gaul, which is the area that we would now call France. And who knows, he may have preached there and challenged the Christians. Who, God is saying, who will go for me across the channel to preach the gospel in the south of England? Oh, you say, preacher, you're speculating. Well, maybe. All we're told is that Crescens went to Galatia and Titus to Dalmatia. That's the eastern side of the Adriatic. Well, you say, preacher, what are you on about here? I'm on about something that must have meant a tremendous amount to Paul as he drew near the end of his life. It is really the beginning of a picture of the spread of the gospel. There was Paul alone, abandoned in jail in Rome. Not quite alone. Can you imagine him thinking about and praying for Crescens in Galatia, wherever that was? Oh, Lord, bless dear Crescens. Give him liberty in preaching. Lord, give him folk to send. Lord, give him souls for his hire. Lord, build your church. And Lord, spread the gospel. And the same with Titus in Dalmatia. Yes, of course, Paul missed these men. Yes, of course, you'd have loved to have had them right there with him. But that's not the way it works. We've been doing a little bit of imagining tonight of people asking questions. I can imagine people coming back, perhaps on a visit to Glasgow and to Sandyford after many years, and saying, "What? Did you ever hear anything of your big tall fellow, you know, with the beard? Wasn't he a vet, Trelogan? Oh, the Trelogans are in Thailand as missionaries. Really? Yes, there was another person I used to talk to. Wasn't he training for the ministry or something? The Lord? Yes. Any new? Oh, they're in Zambia. The Tologans have gone to Thailand. The Dunlops have gone to Zambia. The Noors have gone to Malawi. And others at home and abroad. I remember rightly somebody did say to me once, it's a number of years back now, they asked me about somebody. They said, I don't notice. I said, oh, he's in a church of his own in another part of Scotland now. Now see, this is what we're reading about here. The spread of the gospel. This was Paul's experience. These men who meant so much to him, he didn't keep them. Because you see, they weren't his. And Crescens had gone to Galatia or to Gaul, and Titus to Dalmatia. I can imagine, in a sense, Paul getting into difficulties with church authorities, because no doubt even in these days they had an obsession with statistics and all the rest of it. And they could say, you know, Paul, your attendances are going down. Your statistics are not good. And Paul could well say, well, but you know, church authorities, if all my folk were to come back here, the church wouldn't be big enough to hold them. You see what Paul, you see how his mind is working. Oh, what this must have meant to him. Remember, his working days are almost over. He lifts up his eyes to the field. He sees this one there, and that one there, and that one there, and that one there. And you can imagine him recalling the words of his master. Pray the Lord of the harvest that he will send workers out into the field that is ripe. And that's what was happening. And this is what was always happening. I've always had a great sympathy, if that's the right word. I don't think it is the right word, for the church in Antioch. It wasn't a terribly big congregation. Oh, they would hold their own. After all, you know, they had some great men as elders. They had Paul and they had Barnabas. And they thought, well, we'll hold our own. Let the devil do what he'll do. We'll hold our own. And then God said, excuse me, I want Paul and Barnabas to send them to the mission field. And their two best men were taken from them. Now, do you see how important it is that a new generation of Christians should grow up in a congregation? Not staying as spiritual children, but growing up within the congregation, a new generation of dependable younger men and women who will be ready and able to keep the church and the testimony going, and going on and on and on. Now, some of you folk who are in your 40s, and your 30s, and your 20s, and in your teenage years, are you heading in that direction? Are you becoming the kind of people who will be ready to step right into the front rank and take your place as leaders of Christ's church, because your spiritual integrity is beyond any shadow of doubt? And over against Demas, who deserted him, Paul places Crescens and Titus. Didn't need a whole sermon, really, to consider Titus. There are so many references to him in the epistles. He was, I think, Paul's troubleshooter. I suppose he was Paul's convener of superintendence. And wherever there was a sticky, difficult, dangerous situation in a congregation, who got sent there? Titus. You take your concordance and look up all the references about Titus, and you'll see the kind of things that this man did. Perhaps it's wrong to call him a troubleshooter. Perhaps it was more to call him a peacemaker. You remember all the upheavals and tensions and jealousies and confusions that there were in the church at Corinth. Who was sent to sort it out? Titus. You remember the situation in the church in Corinth, that they were so terribly spiritual that they forgot all about money and providing for the work of the gospel in the mission field. Who was sent to deal with that situation? Titus. And oh, there was a work of the gospel in the island of Crete. Oh dear. Turn over one page in your Bibles to the Paul's letter to Titus, chapter 1 at verse 5. This is why I left you in Crete, that you might amend what was defective and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. Look down to verse 10. For there are many insubordinate men, empty talkers and deceivers, especially the circumcision party. They must be silenced, since they are upsetting whole families by teaching for base gain what they have no right to teach. One of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, "The Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons." And who was sent into that kind of situation to deal with it? Titus. Would you be any use in a situation like that? You see, Titus was a man who could be trusted. Yes. And Paul knew that he could trust Titus to deal with a certain situation, and that he could trust Titus to report back about what he had done with the situation. That's the kind of man that Titus was. And it was this quality of trustworthiness and dependability that made him the kind of man that Paul delighted to have around, to share with and to discuss. But here, at a costly time for Paul, Titus was away again. And Paul let him go. And let him go willingly, because, you see, the work claimed him. And much as Paul wanted him, oh, what it could have meant to Paul if Titus could have stayed there in Rome with him is beyond all expression. But I can imagine Paul saying to Titus, "Now, Titus, the work comes first." That's the kind of man he was. Do you see the kind of commitment that we are talking about tonight? The kind of commitment that will require us to sing shortly our closing hymn, "Take My Life and Let It Be Consecrated, Lord, to Thee." Do you see the commitment of these men? Not Demas. Demas, in love with the present world, deserted me. But these other men were available for God. Only look, or look alone is with me, and we go no further tonight. When I read that, I'm not surprised. Because look, the beloved physician, he was aye there. I don't think Paul ever had to send for look. He was always there when he was needed. Oh, they weren't always together. There were times that their past separated them. But as I read through the story, oh, what a man dear Dr. Luke was. He was always there. Whenever it was possible, and whenever it was needed, Luke was there. And what we're reading about just now is Paul in prison in Rome. And this is very different from that first imprisonment in Rome that we read about at the end of Acts chapter 28, when Paul was able to receive into his prison quarters all those who came to see him, and he had a great ministry of pastoral counsel and preaching and writing. But this is different. You see, the first surge of enthusiasm in the gospel was past. The missionary evangelism of the church had become much more now the slog of church building rather than the excitement of pioneer evangelism. It was more ordinary and it was more costly as the atmosphere of society hardened against Christian things. But the commentators tell me that one thing is evident in this passage that we are studying tonight and next Sunday evening, and it is this. It would appear that there was a shortage of people to do the work. Now I find this disturbing. I find it exercises my heart strangely. Worries me that when we need somebody to work among the young people, most of whom who come from godless homes, with no Christian background or Christian influence, when we need someone to help, it's getting to be terribly difficult. In Sandyford, when I tell other ministers this, they tend not to. Oh, they say, but you've got all these people. Yes. But when we need somebody to work amongst the young folk from godless homes on the weeknights, when we need folk to teach in Sunday school, when we need folk to go to York Hill Sick Children's Hospital on a Sunday morning, to do a Sunday school there, Sunday morning after Sunday morning, we are so often hard-pressed to get the people we need. Now, why? Why? Oh, I could suggest one reason, which would trouble me very deeply. And the reason I could suggest is this, that the answer for the shortage of people to work is that people in Sandyford are not being blessed. Now that would send me home and drive me to my knees if I thought that that was true. But then you see, that's not true. You are being blessed. Richly blessed. As the people around Paul had been richly blessed by his ministry, especially the people in the city of Rome. What it must have meant to these Christians to have Paul ministering the word, granted with limitations, there in the city of Rome. But where were all the people now who had been blessed? There was nobody there except Dr. Luke. So many of the people who had been available had been sent away to the work, not Demas. Whatever else Demas was, he wasn't a worker anymore. But so many of the others had been sent, not by Paul, but by the command and constraint of God, to the work in different places, and only Luke was with Paul, the beloved physician. You read through the Acts of the Apostles and you find there again and again what the commentators call the we passage. Not W-E-E, but just W-E. Now Luke is writing the story, and when he says, now we went here, he means Paul and me. You go through the story and see all the time, oh, what a man this man Luke was. Can you imagine how they encouraged and inspired each other? As I came to the end of my preparation, found myself thinking of a lovely, lovely illustration. Way back in the first book of Samuel, you don't need to turn it up, it's only one verse. It's in the story of David and Jonathan. And Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh and strengthened his hand in the Lord. Now that's what Luke did for Paul. Luke, the beloved physician. Demas didn't do that. Demas demoralized Paul by his desertion. Later on, we'll see that Alexander the coppersmith didn't encourage Paul. He resisted Paul. But Luke was there. I was checking up in a commentary shortly before I came out tonight. I think it was F.F. Bruce's commentary on the Acts of the Apostles. There's a suggestion there that says that very possibly in the story in Acts chapter 27, when Paul was heading out on that famous sea journey going to Rome, there's a very real possibility that Dr. Luke signed on as Paul's personal servant. Now, not as Paul's gentleman, not as a gentleman's gentleman, but he signed on as Paul's slave. Now, slaves had no rights. Slaves had particular quarters on a ship. It wasn't very pleasant. But the slave was allowed to go to his master and be with his master day by day by day. And Dr. Luke signed on as a slave in order to be with Paul and to go with him to Rome. Now, I don't think there was any bravado in this at all. He was a much more straightforward man, Dr. Luke. And his attitude was this. Here is the need. I'm the one who can meet that need. And inasmuch as Paul regarded, as Luke regarded his life as belonging to Christ and not to himself, he had no hesitation. We began with Demas. We end with Luke. Well, where are you? Where are you going? Let's forget about Demas. Let's think of these other men and let's think of the beloved physician. Let's think of the men and women who said very, very simply, and they meant it when they said it, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Amen, and may God bless to us his word.